I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object.
News, entertainment, and more. You will learn something, children. Ocelli.com.
Your regularly scheduled Parallax Views has been interrupted by the Ocelli Effect. Chuck Ocelli is the host and producer of the Ocelli Effect radio program and network at Ocelli.com. That's OCHELLI.com. In addition to Chuck's own program, you can also hear The Age of Transitions, Uncle the Podcast, and Porkin's Policy Review, all of which I have been a guest on. Given my appearances on the Ocelli Effect Network, I thought it was high time that Chuck Ocelli hit Parallax Views with the Ocelli Effect. Rest assured, it's going to be a fascinating freewheeling conversation with Chuck Ocelli, who, amongst other things, has overcome the limitations of legal blindness, exhibited a keen interest in the JFK assassination, survived a rough and tumble youth that brought him into contact with organized crime and outlaw biker gangs, and spent time in the East Coast underground punk and metal scenes. Hell, he even almost became the lead vocalist for the Murder Junkies after the demise of the notorious Gigi Allen. We discuss all that and much more in this freewheeling conversation with a man who has been around the block, Chuck Ocelli. We even get Chuck's inside perspective on the proto-Trumpist militia and patriot movements and their ties to white nationalism. Not gonna want to miss that. Oh, and also we get Chuck's perspective on the civil rights movement. He's got more than a bit of affinity for the Black Panthers and will tell us about his radio shows covering the little-known civil rights leader, T.R.M. Howard. And we even managed to sneak in a little discussion about President Donald Trump's alleged connections to the mob. In other words, this conversation is wild, and it takes us into all kinds of different directions. So, without further ado, Parallax Views gets hit by the Ocelli Effect with Chuck Ocelli. A quick message before our conversation with Chuck Ocelli. Some listeners have expressed interest in my recent conversations with Joseph Green and Daniel Hopsicker, amongst others, pertaining to topics that, depending on your viewpoint, can either be called conspiracy theory or parapolitics. If you're interested in those topics, I'd like to direct you towards Garrison, the Journal of History and Deep Politics, published by S.T. Patrick and Midnight Writer News. The first two issues of Garrison have featured pieces by Freedom of Information Act activist Emma Best, Rwandan genocide researcher Keith Harmon Snow, and the controversial investigative reporter Jim Hogan, whose infamous book, Secret Agenda, provided an alternative explanation for the events surrounding Watergate, among many others. Regardless of your stance on conspiracy theories or parapolitics, my relationship to the subject has proven quite ambiguous itself. You're sure to find something interesting in Garrison, the Journal of History and Deep Politics, available now from Midnight Rider News. Welcome to Parallax Views. This has been a long time coming. Chuck Ocelli of the Ocelli Effect. How's it going?
Well, you know, it's going pretty good. JG, the only guy I know with two letters for a first name. Well, maybe not necessarily the only guy I know, but one of the very few. And glad to be with you. You know, I was feeling bad. Like, all my friends have been on your show, but not me. So I was feeling left out, man. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're correcting that now by having you on. You're sort of known within, I guess, the conspiracy culture, quote unquote, as the blind JFK researcher. But you have a really wild sort of history and story. You were involved in the metal community, you know, and all kinds of different things. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about who you are, beyond maybe what people familiar with you in the JFK community know about. What's your story, man?
What is my story? Well, I'm a kid from Jersey, you know, not so much a kid anymore because I'm 47 now. But no, I was born in the 70s, you know, learned to read around the time that Watergate was in aftermath mode. So my father taught me to read with newspapers and all that kind of good stuff. What do I know? Well, you know, I had a life before I got into the JFK research stuff, which continued on while I was doing the research stuff. A lot of that involved, you know, kind of a rough but interesting upbringing. And then I got into music and thought it was my great escape. I did everything in the music business from being a bouncer to being a performer to working in recording studios, so on and so forth. I made a living, but never was, you know, famous and that kind of thing. And was in the same Jersey Shore scene that most people think of as producing Bruce Springsteen. I played the same bars that he did. But I would prefer that you look at guys like Zakk Wylde who came out of that scene. I would prefer that you look at John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band that came out of that scene. You know, Nuclear Assault, if you like. A lot of other bands and great people came out of the Jersey Shore scene of music. But I didn't come out of it. I was just part of it for a while. And I did a lot of different things there and, you know, wound up doing a lot of research and this and that. And at one point even ended up giving all that up and working for ExxonMobil. You know, doing all this, by the way, you know, the whole why am I the blind JFK researcher? Well, technically speaking, legally, I am blind. I have very little vision. So everything that I've done, I've had to do very, very carefully because of my visual limitations. And that has made life interesting. And, you know, as far as when people talk about, well, gee, I don't have time to read up on, check up on, look up this, that, the third thing or whatever. I point to myself and say, well, look, I've got this limited ability to do so, and you don't got an excuse, do you? So there you go. And but I'm more than happy to be associated with my website and the little radio network and my show and all that. And I'm just kind of grateful to be alive anymore, to be honest with you, after the life I've led. And there you go. There's a bunch of stuff they don't talk about in the JFK end of the pool, right?
Well, I was going to say, people really should check out the Ocelli Effect Network just because there's your show, there's Aaron Franz's show, and of course, Porkin's Policy. You guys cover a really wide range of topics, sort of centered around sort of questioning the consensus reality or the mainstream narrative around things. Maybe we could get into that. What led you to sort of questioning the way things are presented as we know it in the history books and sort of, you know, looking at things from the alternative perspective?
All right. Well, I'll try and do this real fast because I know I've told this story on my show a lot, but let me see if I can squeeze it into 60 seconds for you. I was 4 years old, and my father had been a Vietnam veteran. He was in rough shape. He had suffered from PTSD. He was having a hard time in the real world, and he wound up taking his life. So fast forward 15 years, actually. I turned around and decided I might try to go to college. Now, a blind guy gets a little bit of help for college, but the son of a veteran might get a little more help for college, and I was poor, so let's see what assistance we can get. I attempted to get assistance as the surviving, you know, child of a veteran, right? And my government told me that I was a liar and that I could actually be prosecuted for asserting such things, despite the fact that I knew my father had been in the military. But apparently no file of his military service existed. And that was the case all the way from 1991 to 2007, quite honestly. the disappeared file. And I knew right then and there that, first of all, my own government didn't have its own facts straight when it came to things I knew for a fact. And in 2007, they accidentally actually came across a file that proves that at least he was in the military, although it's still loaded with a bunch of fictitious information. You know, here we go. I had to wait how many years? Let's see. 17 years. Wait, no. Sorry, 16 years in order to get the truth about something that had to do with somebody who died in 1976, right? So, you know, this tells you about exactly what type of pronouncements are made by the government and so on and so forth. Now, that, in a really weird, indirect sort of way, and a fascination with the story of how it is that a guy gets killed in police custody, being Lee Harvey Oswald, caused me to read up on the case and start to wonder about what authors were putting in their books. So I tried to contact the real people from the books as I was traveling, being a musician, all that. And, you know, it was funny. I often found that independent authors, the official story, a lot of other things that are meant to tell you the real truth about somebody, something, an incident, whatever, quite often did not match the accounts of the real people who were involved. So that, I guess, and an unhealthy sort of opposition to authority in general from a very early age.
No, that's very healthy. Don't say that's unhealthy. It's good to question authority and think for yourself, as Tim Leary would say.
Well, see, but there you go. But how healthy of a challenger was Tim Leary, considering that he was compromised? See, question everything.
You know, I've gotten to that point recently after reading. There's this author, Eric Davis, who just wrote a book called High Weirdness. It's about Philip K. Dick, Terrence McKenna, Robert Anton Wilson, the sort of 60s, 70s counterculture. And it broke my heart a little bit because he reveals that Terrence McKenna apparently was really into, like, Ayn Rand and objectivism, and I'm not a fan of that. But, you know, we have to question our idols, too. Or as, you know, the no-wave bands in New York would say, the no-wave punk bands, you got to kill your idols sometimes.
Right, right. And, you know, I love the punk attitude, man. I always appreciated that kind of music, the minimalist, you know, the ugly irregularities in the art. I guess that's another thing that sort of drove me, you know. And that's the thing about punk music that is often forgotten when people look back at it now, you know, and they might kind of boil it down to Fear and doing Beef Bologna on Saturday Night Live, but or whatever show that was. They might think that that's all there is to it, and the Sex Pistols and all that. But there was a mentality there, and a real chance for a counterculture that continuously was interrupted one way or another at the various waves of what we might think of as punk music. And I think there was a real chance for mind expansion there that goes well beyond the psychedelic age where people think of it as mind expansion, you know, the days of Hendrix and all that kind of stuff. But I examine culture in a different way than a lot of other people do. And, you know, for the record, even though I loved punk music, I was more of a metal guy, actually. A Black Sabbath fan from the day I was, well, able to be a fan of anything. And matter of fact, I learned how to walk listening to Black Sabbath. So you know, my whole life, I have kind of stuck to the things that I love, and the things that I appreciate, and the things I can actually trust and verify, which is very little in this world. So here we go, right?
Well, you know, I know we were talking off air about you've had strange experiences even growing up since you were like a little kid. I don't know if you want to talk about that on air, but I think it would be an interesting avenue.
Well, you know, we could go in a lot of different directions there, right? You know, I mentioned before I kind of had a rough childhood, and I did, and I'm writing about it now, which is making me relive a whole bunch of stuff. You know, imagine everything basically horrible that could happen to a kid who's basically been either neglected or the only attention he gets is usually, you know, well-placed ass whipping, and I don't mean a spanking. You know, like if that's all you got at a certain point, you either learn to survive or you learn to hide or you learn to navigate the world in a completely unique way from your contemporaries, you know. And so I did that. And there's a lot to that story. I don't know which direction you want to go in, but I recently told a story on air. Which I'm not going to include in the book about, you know, being one of these kids who was, planted on a bar stool, you know, in the dark part of a bar while, mom went and conducted business. And, business is, something I'll leave to your listeners' imagination if they'd like. And, you know, I'm sitting in a bar for many hours in the dark. And, after a little while, learned to play pool a bit. And had an interesting time learning to play pool. Again, blind kid, remember, sitting in a bar at the age of 5, 6, right? Learning to shoot pool. And every once in a while, the drunks would have fun and come and challenge the little kid with the pool cue. So I beat a guy one night who got pretty angry. And the end of the story there, which I called Barroom Blitz on air, is pretty much I out of nowhere, I just... out of self-defense, I ended up having to whack this guy out with a pool cue, and I'm 6 years old, and I was totally, you know, it was like the first real serious violent confrontation I'd been in with an adult. It wouldn't be the last one, but that introduced me, believe it or not, into a strange place locally, where, you know, I entertained one of the local wise guys that night with that whole incident. And that ended up putting me in a place where I could actually earn a little bit of money for myself. And I got very familiar with, you know, guys whose names you may or may not know. And even in the book, I'm not going to necessarily reveal the identity of everybody that that trusted me to be around them for things. But I'm going to let you know about the places and some of the things I saw for sure. That's going to be an interesting thing because I am writing the life story book as a practice run for the JFK book that I hope to release at some point if I live long enough, and I can get it together. So, there's a lot of directions to go in, man. I mean, I could tell you about horrible things that happened. I could tell you about, you know, weird experiences. I could tell you about learning how to, you know, do medical procedures for bikers, because I also got sucked into the you know, the nexus of outlaw biker groups and
things. Like the Hell's Angels and stuff.
Well,
really
not the Hell's Angels, actually the Pagans. And the Pagans, I had a blessing from a going to my house. I was blessed by Mother Club. You could go to my house and seek medical treatment as a Pagan. And it was me a few years later than the six-year-old me, slightly steadier hand, but still a young kid. I knew how to do things medically to patch people up and to help them out. It was a neutral ground. You couldn't come and cause a problem there because you would have an issue with Mother Club if you did. So that's an odd little nexus of stuff, too. And a lot of people don't know that the outlaw bikers are also closely tied to organized crime figures in many places, especially in the Northeast. I'm never going to reveal all the secrets about that time in my life, but it gave me a unique perspective that allows me to see through a lot of the silliness that's put out there in the media regarding the truth about the criminal underworld, the truth about the players in it, and the people that actually benefit from it. So there you go. See, you didn't even expect that part of the interview at all, did you?
Well, I was going to say the organized crime thing I was interested in. We don't have to, like, go into, like, details because that, you know, I've talked to Ed Opperman about it because I think we've all known people that have, like, some very shady ties to the underworld. Me, you, and Ed, and probably a lot of other people I've talked to. I've talked to people, and I've always found people within that underworld very interesting because they often have a lot of the same sort of questioning of narratives that we can engage in a lot of times.
Well, you know, a fascinating connection between me and Opperman. This is wild. Opperman was kind of in a criminal nexus before he straightened out his life and decided to become a private investigator, right?
The hippie mafia, right?
Yeah, I mean, he was just involved in moving huge amounts of cannabis, and things like that. And he got himself in some trouble and was able to walk away. But what's fascinating is he's older than me, but from the same region. Him and I actually know some of the same people. And it's really funny, like, there was this guy who was on HBO Mob Stories some years ago. They had a series called Mob Stories. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Yes. Yeah, I like that show.
Okay, do you remember the one about getting out of the mob?
No, only vaguely.
Okay, well, getting out of the mob was one of the individual programs there, right? And they talked about, you know, Sammy the Bull being a rat and a couple other people that turned state's witness. But they also included a character that both Ed and I knew, which his name is Brother Frank Minucci. Okay, this is how he's known today, Brother Frank, because he was high up in one of the elite sections of the Hell's Angels. He was well mob connected, on his way to becoming part of the Lucchese family officially. At the time he decided to get out and all that stuff, he tells his story on there. Ed and I both know this guy, right? And I knew him after, too, because I've known him as a motorcycle preacher as well. And at one point, I actually gave him a job. And the two of us were laughing because, I'm probably the only human being that never got, you know, the hell beat out of me after firing Brother Frank Minucci, who was a nomad with the Hell's Angels, had been a mob guy, all that kind of stuff, you know. He's on there you'll hear him telling stories about, yeah, so, you know, a guy owes me money, maybe I, you know, almost like Iceman sounding, where it's like, guy owes me money, maybe I drag him behind my car for a little while till he's ready to pay me, you know, this kind of stuff. We knew and worked with people like this in our misguided youths, let's just say. And it's not something that's a point of pride or that I've even thought of to bring out. It's just a matter of, like, I almost felt like, well, everybody's probably run across these kind of people, and I'm starting to discover not everybody's been there.
I'm always surprised by that myself. I mean, I've been around some seedy characters in my life, and I'm always surprised when people are, like, shocked, that, you know, oh, you knew someone that was involved in, you know, sort of crime and that stuff. And I'm like, well, I just thought everyone has, you know, has that like one degree of separation. Apparently not.
No, it's a weird thing to discover that not everybody has been an associate at some point of something. Cause it seems like we live in a very criminal society that's very much in denial. You know, and they want to act as though they have the moral high ground when it comes to a lot of things. It's really a delusion. Most of the time they don't even realize, the criminality of various things that are going on that they pay legitimate homage to, you know, so often. Like, I find it hilarious that people get upset about, you know, like, we can talk about current politics. I find it hilarious that people, like, oh my God, how dare you say that, you know, President Trump has been involved with criminal people. Well, first of all, I'm from Jersey. So, you know, problem there, Chief. All right. Next thing, you don't get any construction work done in the 1970s and 80s in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, or possibly even parts of Pennsylvania.
Pittsburgh, definitely. That's definitely true in Pittsburgh. Back in the day, yeah.
Right. Without having to work with people who are mafia. Not even, you know, no organized crime. I'm talking about Sicilian business people. Okay. You don't get any work done otherwise. So it's impossible for Trump and his family businesses to have done anything during that time period without having dealt with, okay, the Gambinos, for starters. Okay.
The Genovese crime family, I also hear, has connections to Trump.
Absolutely. You know, it's impossible. There's a whole lot of things that you, how do you function and have a business in Atlantic City? Well, you know, he didn't function too well, but for the time that he did, you're going to have to deal with some of these elements. They're just there. It's, you know, look, the sun's going to rise tomorrow. All right. I mean, it's a fact of life. So it's impossible to imagine that this guy is not tied to criminality right there. I don't even need any other connective tissue. I got to tell you that that's all there is to it. Right. But it's like, how dare you say that? Well, what about the fact that he stiffs people on, you know, their contracts? What about the fact that he fights against immigrants, but he hires them all over the place on his properties? What about? Pay no attention to any of the facts in front of me. I've got a story I want to believe is what a lot of people do.
Well, I was going to add real quick. I mean, just talk to anyone in New York. I mean, who are you going to trust? Are you going to trust the people just the common Joes in New York? Are you going to trust Trump? I'm going to trust the common people who basically are all aligned saying, yeah, Trump's, you know, been involved in crime. I mean, every New Yorker knows this.
But one way or another, and even if you know nothing and you don't know anything about the construction business, if you just encountered his security people, all the people he hired, yeah, he hired some ex-cops and things like that, but he hired thugs of all kinds to do his security everywhere. I lived in New York City, too. I lived on the Lower East Side. I could step out of my apartment on 9th Street, and I could throw a rock and land it in Tompkins Square Park, okay? I mean, now that's not Trump's neighborhood, you know, and also remember, he's just a real estate hustler from Queens, to be honest with you. But the thing is, anybody in New York who had to do business, who knew the landscape there in New York, in New Jersey, again, like I said, okay, and I was born in Jersey. I lived there most of my life, even, you know, though I live in the South now. I lived in Jersey most of my life. I lived in New York part of my life. I know who this guy is. Okay. And it was amazing to me that anybody would take him seriously because they're so concerned that, you know, the president does the right thing, right? And they want the country to do the right thing. But, you know, again, it's all about the lens in which people look at things through. And it's funny, like you said, you'd wonder, wouldn't people say, I mean, like this Bill de Blasio is running for president now. It's hilarious. You know, everybody in New York's like, what, are you kidding me? You know, but somehow there he is. I don't know how much longer he's going to last. But, you know, yeah, he can run a city maybe. But this is not the guy to be president. This is not going to be somebody who's going to be separate from Trump. You know, not really, even though he's on the opposite side of the ticket. Let's get real, man. You know, you want to do something different than actually do something different. Don't swap one criminal for another and then complain. And I got to tell you, I got a lot more respect, actually, for, you know, street level gangsters than I do for politicians. And I'll tell you why. A street level gangster, if you pay your protection money, your store might not get burned down. You might actually get protected. Okay. You pay the politicians and there's no way that you have enough money to pay them. It doesn't matter. And they take your taxes anyway. So you're still paying protection money, basically, to a mob that doesn't even know who you are.
Yeah, it's funny. It reminds me of, I remember reading this quote once from, it was attributed to Lucky Luciano, where Luciano apparently said, well, you know, I do all this stuff and everyone's mad about it, but the government does it and no one seems to blink an eye. I think I'm better than the government about this stuff, though.
Yeah.
And I just found it funny because
You know, I can see the argument he was making.
Well, you know, a side note, I throw at you the hint for something that I have not been able to completely verify. Ready for this one? What was the adopted name of Lucky Luciano on paper? It was Charles Edward, right? Yeah, that happens to be my first and middle name, by the way. And, you know, family stories tell me that actually that's great-uncle Sal is actually, because his name was Salvatore. And quite frankly, this is why the name repeats itself in my family line after that, because this is a guy who separated himself from his family with the name he chose. Okay. And I find it interesting because they organized crime in a way here in this country that, you know, by building the commission and doing the things they did. And yet we know for a fact today that, you know, what does the government do when it needs to protect the docks during World War II?
Operation Underworld. Lucky Luciano worked with, you know, our government on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, this is a family story I was told as a kid. Is that actually Great Uncle Sal, when he was in prison in Sicily, was called upon to do some service, which assisted with the invasion of Sicily, first of all, but also assisted with protection of various ports that people he knew had control over. You know, and I knew that story long before, you know, a bunch of books came out and a bunch of people had made assertions in recent years. So, you know, my understanding is that I may actually have an ancestral tie to the man.
Wow.
And I am not ashamed of that at all. I would be a lot more ashamed if I was tied to George Washington, to be honest with you.
Well, you know, this mob stuff is interesting because it a lot of times it ties into the conspiracy world, but it's usually the conspiracies that no one talks about anymore. Like, yep. For instance, the Octopus murders that Danny Casalero covered, that has organized crime fingerprints. My favorite is, are you familiar with the Vatican Bank scandal and Roberto Calvi's death?
I mean,
it's those are the conspiracies that really get to me because I'm like, ooh, this is like some spooky territory.
Well, you know, it seems spooky, but what it comes down to is that the intelligence agencies have always been happy to employ people who knew how to get a job done. And if there was an organized criminal structure that was already doing some of the business that they needed to get done, why not employ them? It's actually a fairly logical thing for the intelligence agencies to have done. But, you know, the mob control of things is more of an illusion than people realize. Like, you know, quite frankly, yeah, they're often employed by. And it doesn't matter, by the way, it's not always the Italians, but I mean the French mobsters that have been employed for things. And believe it or not, there are French mobsters, Asian organized crime elements that have been employed to get certain jobs done by other nations, you know, outside of our own. It's endless. You know, when you take a look at the actual way that, you know, ready, willing and able are people that are willing to take money to do things off the books, right? So why not? If you've got to keep your operations off the books, you hire a criminal. They get busted. Look, they're a criminal. They were going to kill somebody anyway. I mean, and you don't have to look any further than the CIA's guide on assassinations. Now, if somebody doesn't know about, you know about this, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But go on for my listeners that may be unfamiliar.
Your listeners might not know, but it's worth a Google, people. Go ahead and look at the CIA's guide on assassinations. Just put that phrase into a search engine. They literally had a step-by-step, what type of weapons to use, what type of people to employ, everything else. And the most hilarious element of it all, and I've covered this on my show a few times, I covered this on Corbett's show, other places, I love pointing this out, that also throughout this, they tell you about terrorist events that you can use to your advantage. They tell you about assassinations directly. It's more than an assassination guide. They tell you about propaganda, how to handle the media. Everything is in this guide, step by step, how to get illegal operations done. Okay. And then at one point you turn to a page which basically says, and you can find the quote yourself if you like, if you find the document, you can find it over at Carmine Savastano's website. I know he's got it over there. All right. And again, I've done several shows with him on it. So if you go to TPAAK, TPAAK.com, I know you can get a copy of it, but find it your own way. Thing is, it says right in there, though, you should not commit operational details to paper. Okay. So in case you're, I don't know, in case you got too much cannabis in you this morning or something, let me enlighten you. The reason why I know this is because somebody left this around on paper. Okay. So I'm not saying that they're the all-knowing, all-seeing, omnipotent, perfectly infallible agency. They never have been. But the idea that they would utilize criminal elements, there's a whole section on that in the assassination guide itself. There's a whole lot of operational evidence that we've been able to acquire through Freedom of Information Acts, the JFK Records Collection Act, that show over and over and over again. It doesn't matter. If there were people that could get the job done, if they were mentally unstable, it didn't matter. If they were Nazis, it didn't matter. If they were enemy soldiers, it didn't matter. If they were mass murderers, it didn't matter. If they were rapists, if they were pedophiles, if they were criminals of any type and stripe, the Central Intelligence Agency and various other intelligence agencies, especially in America, but kid yourself not, across the world, are more than happy to hire criminal elements to get work done, especially when it's dirty.
Well, okay? Yeah, especially, I was just going to add, you know, especially, I've always thought it's plausible, at least, that CIA would work with people that are, you know, con men or disreputable, just because if something comes out later, you can say, oh, well, this guy is incredible. You know, it works as cover.
Well, right. Like the whole thing with why is it, and this is well known. You can go and look at the congressional, investigations in the 1970s. And you can just, again, I'll give you another phrase, Castro plots, CIA Castro plots. Go ahead and search it. Okay. Again, I point to my friend Carmine's work. All right. I'm sorry. I gotta. But he's done an incredible amount of stuff, put it out there for free for you to look at. But go ahead and search it. Find it anywhere you want. Church Committee, Rockefeller, Pike, okay, they all came up with these different elements about various things that the agency was involved in. But Castro plots, I want you to focus on those because, see, that was the perfect operation. Get the mob people involved to try and deal with Castro, okay? And the Kennedys are not completely innocent on this. Don't let anybody tell you that either. But fact is... that these things were dreamt up long before JFK took office. But anyway, the idea of dealing with Fidel Castro, who the CIA never got to, he died of old age, with mob people is there. It's right there. They brought a lot of the, you know, best known people at the time, what, Tropicante and, Marcello. They brought all these guys up there to testify, Johnny Roselli, hey, you know, tell us what you know. But it's very real. They've always done this, and it's very convenient. And especially with an operation like Cuba, look, they had a personal grudge. They had a stake in it already. You know, the heroin dealers in Marseille, they had a stake in it already. And once you get your mind wrapped around that, it's not all that fantastic to look into things like Iran-Contra or, you know, the current events regarding how the heroin is getting everywhere across the planet right now. And I urge people to take a look at Doug Valentine's work on that. Not only the cocaine and heroin, but the rest of the culture regarding the war on drugs, right? Or the war of drugs, I should say. All that stuff, man. It all links together rather nicely. And again, operationally, who do you use? The people that already know how to get the dirty work done. Kind of makes sense. You got experience? I got a job application. How much experience do you have? I need dirty stuff done. JG, you got a background in it? Maybe I can use you. You know what I'm saying? So it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Definitely, definitely. You know, it's something I was talking with someone else about when we were just did a show on conspiracy theories, since conspiracy is like the new hip thing now. With Epstein's, suicide or murder, depending on what your viewpoint is. And I was saying how, like, a lot of these people in the conspiracy community, a lot of them, I often wonder, whose hand they're serving. I mean, you mentioned Douglas Valentine. He wrote a book on the Phoenix program. One of the heroes of a lot of, like, conspiracy guys is this Senator John DeCamp. But right. DeCamp was involved with a lot of the people in the Phoenix program. And he was trained by, I think, William Colby. And, you know, people like Ted Gunderson, this ex-FBI agent who, you know, was claiming to expose all the satanic pedophiles. And it's like, Gunderson was like a dude that was like pro-COINTELPRO. I mean, he worked in COINTELPRO against the Black Panthers. Why should I trust him? I mean, you get some weird landmines when you get into any of these worlds, whether it's conspiracy, organized crime, just about any subculture. It's pretty wild.
Right, and there you go, bringing up COINTELPRO, right? So, how about we go into that for a second? Have you ever interviewed anybody from the Black Panthers, the original Black Panthers?
I've actually wanted to. People like Bobby Seale. I think Larry Pinkney is still around. I've been thinking of getting into contact with a few people.
Yeah, Larry is friendly with me, although lately he's been out of contact with me, and I'm not sure if there's something personally wrong. Quite frankly, but Larry is my favorite guy. Bobby Seale has been evasive with me about coming on the show, but let's work with Larry since I know him well. This is a guy who was able to get a hold of his FBI file, right? And, you know, he was to be neutralized. That's a word they used, neutralized. Now, neutralization of an individual by COINTELPRO... meant pretty much, let's get them in prison or let's get them dead. Let's ruin them and neutralize their ability to be effective. Larry was especially dangerous because he had a uncanny ability to reach across racial and political divides. And he's a unique character even today. Fascinating story, the man's life is, you know, when he was in prison in Canada. He actually took his case to the UN, and I'm not, you know, one of these fans of the UN, mind you, but took his case to the UN and got them to accept his petition that he was being held as a political prisoner. And, you know, achieved release after spending his, you know, some time there in prison in Canada. Interesting story, you know, but one that nobody wants to talk about. They don't really even anymore want to talk about the Black Panthers and exactly what that organization was. In fact, today, most political talking heads will turn around and, you know, what do? They say the Ku Klux Klan and the Black Panthers as if there is an equivalency. And that goes all the way back to, you know, our very government was producing coloring books for children that were meant to demonize these people that were in the Black Panthers, that were meant to, you know, scare whitey, basically. And I find it remarkable, especially considering that, you know, the Black Panthers were very much for your Second Amendment right. You know, patriot people, how about that? They were very much for your Second Amendment right. They became a scary organization when they actually showed up in the Capitol building in California armed. And the reason why they did it is because there was no law against doing so. Okay. And they had been following around police when they were going to patrol their neighborhoods because the police were abusing individuals in their neighborhoods. And all of that stuff combined with serving kids breakfast in the morning before they went to school, clothing drives, food drives for people, stuff like that. Huge organization. Bet that a lot of people, when they think Black Panthers, don't think of any of this. They just think about guns and berets and maybe sunglasses. But I got to tell you, there's a lot more to that organization. And it's fascinating, too, because one of the origin stories that that Larry tells and others who are Black Panthers will tell the same story, although it varies a little bit between individuals. And they're trying to protect the legacy. People like Bobby Seale are trying to protect the legacy of the reality of that organization now. And they have been involved in that for a long time. But, you know, fact is that one of the most interesting origin stories is that it really started out because they needed a traffic signal on a dangerous intersection. And they came together for that reason. Okay. You know, it's hard to wrap your mind around the demonization of an organization that is seen as, you know, terrorist and everything else.
Yeah, I've always gotten very, very annoyed with, you know, growing up around Pittsburgh, we have a lot of, you know, working class white conservatives who just hate the Black Panthers. And I'm like, you know, they didn't just walk around with guns. They opened up food pantries. They helped in their community. No one talks about any of that aspect. Oh, they scared the cops, though. That's a crime.
Yeah, scaring the cops. You know, with all the people that are killed in police interaction on a daily basis in this country, which, by the way, is far more people than are killed in mass shootings, in air quotes I hold up right now, you know, on a yearly basis, but doesn't quite get the headlines all across the country, and it's not just Black people either. Okay, guess what? Maybe somebody does need to scare the cops a little bit and make them remember that, you know, that we're not all worthy targets and we're not all, you know, subject to the whims of them justifying our homicides. Because a lot of unarmed people are still getting killed every single day in this country now.
Well, I mean, just in general, too, with regards to the Panthers and the civil rights movement and more militant figures like, say, Malcolm X, although Malcolm X was sort of a right-wing reactionary in that he was a Black nationalist. Like, I understand why things like the Black Panthers and Malcolm X, why they were around at that time. People only like to talk about MLK, and although I think people gloss over how radical MLK was. I really like MLK, too. But, you know, people don't understand when it comes to the issues that the Black community have faced over the years. I mean, it doesn't just end with, you know, the Civil War and slavery. I mean, look at the Tuskegee Institute syphilis study. I mean, I understand why there's a lot of militants.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me do something here, and this is an interesting experiment. Have you paid attention to some of my recent shows, and did you see the name T.R.M. Howard come up?
No. Tell me a little bit more.
Okay, good. That's perfect. Have you ever heard the name T.R.M. Howard?
No.
Okay. Theodore Roosevelt Mason Howard. That is his full name. He was a doctor. Now, Rosa Parks was inspired by a speech from this man before she decided not to move on the bus. He was also a mentor of Medgar Evers. You know that name?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Interesting, though, you don't know T.R.M. Howard's name. Now, I didn't know very much about the man. I knew a very basic sort of thing, but again, worth a Google search for your listeners. T.R.M. Howard, I had on two professors who wrote a book about him. And he is probably one of the most under-recognized individuals because he's a mixed bag. You can't go left, you can't go right with this guy. But he actually fought in Mississippi. You know, you hear about fighting segregation and coloreds only and whites only bathrooms and stuff like that, right? Well, imagine this circumstance. There were service stations in Mississippi where there was a whites only bathroom and no other bathroom, right? So this guy organized a boycott, which put pressure on every service station in Mississippi to the point where their, you know, national parent companies came down on them and said, you got to change this, right? You don't hear about this guy, though, in February, do you? You don't hear about him during Black History Month, do you? Okay, this guy was involved. Now, he was also a pro-gun sort of guy. He was also, you know, at one point he carried a Tommy gun for his own defense. Okay. So, you know, not Mr. Peacenik all the way around. Now, I'm not saying that this is a, you know, an exemplary, absolutely, he's got his flaws and all that stuff, but he became a doctor, actually created businesses and things in a Black only town in Mississippi in the 1950s. Have you ever heard of the Emmett Till case?
Yes.
He is one of the people who was agitating for and pushing for a real investigation, a real prosecution during the time that Emmett Till was disappeared. See, look, he's connected to Medgar Evers. He's connected to Rosa Parks. He's connected to all these people. And that's just in his time in Louisiana. He winds up moving up to Chicago and doing more stuff, including running to try and become a congressman. He failed. But he ran to try and become a congressman on the Republican ticket. Okay. This is an interesting character. there is a lot of history about the time in this country that people refer to about the civil rights movement, which is not known. I absolutely point to Dr. King, and I absolutely point to Malcolm, and I appreciate Malcolm a lot more because I don't feel as though the strategy of nonviolence is always the best way to go.
People get very mad at me because I've always said, I kind of end up on the Malcolm X side more than MLK.
Yeah, no, and I do too, because again, violence, when you're defending yourself is actually intelligence. You know, I mean, and I'm paraphrasing, man, but I believe it, and I believe he was correct.
Well, that's what the Black Panthers were doing too. That what they were doing was in self-defense, and yet people don't. People who want to politicize it don't talk about it that way. You know,
right.
There's so many lies and just BS that people will push. You know, it's complete disinformation.
No, absolutely true. But here's the other thing is that now you think about this one figure that I'm telling you about, right? He's connected to the most infamous case. And for those people who don't know about the Emmett Till case, let me just throw this one at you. Emmett Till, allegedly, made some sort of remark to a white woman, and then some men snatched him up from his uncle's home where he was visiting, and they tortured and murdered him. They mutilated him, castrated him, hung him, and all that. His body was discovered broken and beaten. He was 14 years old, by the way. Okay, go ahead. Do a Google search on the boy. All right. And his body was finally returned to his mother, who lived in Chicago, which, again, he was visiting his uncle down south at the time. His death is considered one of the fire starter moments for the civil rights time period that would follow because of this. You know, and we need to recognize that, you know, when you're talking about self-defense in the South, you had a lot of things going on, but it wasn't the only place where segregation and abuse of people in general for one reason or another was simply acceptable in a lot of parts of this country. Maybe you couldn't necessarily just lynch somebody and take away parts of their body for souvenirs, all right, if you went a little further north, but down south you could. You know, and people didn't get prosecuted. And, there were probably co-conspirators in the Till case and everything else. And it's something to explore. Proper context. We need to understand that. And it's not that long ago either. You know, so when you take a look at that and the things that came before, you know, Dr. King marching on Washington and what happened with Malcolm and what happened with Medgar Evers, again, also very much not ever mentioned.
Well, can I cut in real quick on the MLK subject? I want to say real quick, the thing they'll never teach you in school, unless, you know, I learned about it in university, but they never, ever would talk to us about how MLK, near the end of his life, was saying, in order for civil rights to go forward, we need to look at economic justice, we need to be anti-war, we need to combine all these issues because they're all connected to the same struggle. They never tell you that in school.
They don't
whitewash his history. It's ridiculous.
No, they don't. And you know what? Here comes my opinions. All right. It's my concerted opinion that because his rhetoric began to shift to that only at the very end of his life, that is precisely why he needed to be murdered. Because he was going to speak a lot more about Vietnam. He was already doing it and against the military industrial complex effectively, which is a death sentence if you do that and you have any sort of power. And quite frankly, the idea that he was recognizing that the economic oppression of people is a serious factor. And I take you back to T.R.M. Howard, because this guy, through economic empowerment, did a lot of things that really did frighten the establishment. And again, he's almost completely scrubbed from history as far as you know. And he encountered people you wouldn't believe, the people he encountered in his life. Famous figures, Dick Gregory had met him and known him. I hear tell Muhammad Ali knew him. There is a lot to this. Okay. And there were a lot of people like this who did a lot of work that is overshadowed by the overemphasis on, you know, figures like King and figures like X. And a lot of people think that those are the only two men who were doing things at that time. It's not true. And when you enter into the equation that all of them, at one point or another, were targeted by this government, the United States government, they were targeted either under the idea that a black messiah might rise up and cause a serious event to occur in the country that would create an uprising and a disturbance everywhere, or because an organization needs to be neutralized. And again, another name to look up is Fred Hampton. All right. And the murder of Fred Hampton. Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, no, I'm sorry. It's just that there's so much to this that is as yet unknown, unfocused on, that academia is unaware of or refusing to acknowledge regarding the true history of just the past century. This is one of the necessary things and one of the goals, you know, of what it is I do. And I think you and I actually share this. You know, you should know about the things that are being hidden from you, because they're usually being hidden from you for a good reason. And, when you get into the modern day stuff and the endless rabbit holes, the rabbit warren as presented to you by M.C. Escher, okay, of Epstein and his saga and all of that, the weaponization of conspiracy theory as opposed to it being part of the opposition, and the adaptation of it into this very ignorant paradigm that exists right now regarding a whole lot of stuff that is being sent out there as what I call weapons of mass distraction constantly. These are the things that we're actually confronted by, and these are the things that if we don't do something to resist them, will become the narratives of the future. And, you know, yeah, there's only going to be two guys who stood up during the time of civil rights, because maybe there wasn't that much to stand up to. Maybe they'll minimalize and sanitize that. And maybe we'll sanitize the evil actions of our government who, you know, let's just go to more modern times. The absolute wanton destruction of a sovereign nation under false pretenses in Iraq. I don't know. That sounds pretty evil to me.
Well, you know, I was going to add, I may have slightly different views on this. I have a very, when it comes to conspiracy theories, I can be very critical, but I'm also very understanding of conspiracy theories, and I think conspiracies do happen. I think the minimalization of the civil rights movement and sort of reducing it to two people, I've always taken that as just this symptom of... There's this idea, I think, that has overtaken America that it's not movements of people, of social movements that change history. It's single individuals. And anyone who really studies history knows that that's not true. And yet we're taught that because that's the dominant paradigm. You know, it's always the one person that changes everything. And the only other thing I was going to add in regards to academia, for me, the problem with academia is it's like an inverted pyramid. You start out when you go to college with, you know, general knowledge. And then as you keep going further and further into higher education, your field of expertise gets smaller and smaller. Mm. So you have people that are covering one issue and only maybe like 12 to 100 other people are reading about it in academia. And the knowledge just becomes entrapped in a very small circle rather than shared with the general public. It's my problem with academia is really that I think knowledge should be available to everyone.
No, I understand that. And as somebody who has never attained anything more than a high school education, you know, because, like I said, I was going to go to college and couldn't find the money and couldn't find the wherewithal. So I just figured, well, let me get on with, you know, making a living somehow. And I did it with music. But the reality of tunnel vision in general, this is the thing that we got to fight. You know, there's a lot on the peripheral that is no longer witnessed and therefore closes out part of the reality. And the media does this. Literature does this. The internet has created, you know, various types of, well, on-demand, self-replicating, self-imposed echo chambers where you can crawl into a place and stay away from any information that might challenge you a bit. You know, the ultimate safe space. You can develop it all for yourself with your smartphone every day. Okay. To me, this is the danger of a lack of context that that is intentional.
Well, it's really bad now, too. I mean, I was just talking to Roberta Glass of the True Crime Report, and I was telling her off air how she first off, for people that don't know, she's been covering the Nexium case, the Keith Raniere sex cult that involved Allison Mack, the actress from Smallville. And I was telling her, you know, there's people looking at this case that are reporting on it simply as a political weapon against left-wingers. They're saying, oh, see, this cult is proof that, you know, progressives are all evil, you know, satanic pedophiles or whatever. Same with, like, what Mike Cernovich does now, that clown, that stooge. And, you know, I can't talk to those people because they look at me and they know, you know, I'm sort of a lefty kind of guy. I like Bernie. I know you've had criticisms of Bernie, but you're one of the people that can still talk with people even when they disagree. These people that look at Nexium that just want it to be political, they won't talk to me. They just won't have anything to do with me. And it goes on the left, too, where there's people on the left that will flip out if I have a libertarian on. You know, you can't – everyone wants to just have their space. They want there to be no discussion. And I think that's a very bad development.
Well, you know, gun to my head in 2016, if I would have been forced to vote for somebody who was out there eligible as a presidential candidate, I probably would have chosen Bernie, which a lot of people might be surprised at, considering the fact that, you know, I didn't think Ron Paul was a bad guy either. But here's the thing. I am not easily relegated to one of these categories. So, you know, the right wingers hate me because they think I'm a lefty. The left wingers hate me because they think I'm a right winger. It's hilarious. And quite honestly, even though I was, you know, for a time considered acceptable among, you know, the sort of what I'll call the patriotic mythology media out there, I quickly became unacceptable in 2016.
Oh, really? Do you mean the people? I'm familiar with them. I call them the Patriot Movement, as in P-A-Y. Patriot, because they're sort of these militia type, militant, sort of right wingers, and yet I don't see them going against the establishment at all. I don't think they've ever really went that much against the establishment in a lot of ways.
That's the interesting thing about them is, and I used to have people who were legitimate members of various militias and militia groups. I mean, I had a friend who was, you know, right there on the ground at the Bundy Ranch. I was highly critical of the nonsense that went on, you know, regarding the Oregon standoff, and that caused me some problems.
You know, the Bundys have been sort of cast out now, too, because they're in opposition to what Trump is doing along the border.
Yeah, well, see, but here it is, the Patriot media, right? These are basically, look, let's bring it down to brass tacks. A couple of things. These are right wingers who used to be considered too crazy to be invited under the right wing tent. Okay,
that's John Birchers almost. Well, now the John Birchers are even more acceptable in a lot of ways.
Right, and John Birch, you know, a lot of the John Birch Society speeches from the old days sound a lot more reasonable than these people. And here's the thing: they actually brought about a lot of patriot mythology, I'll call it. And a lot of conspiracy theory that was shared by the white nationalist movements as well, But there are honest to goodness legitimate individuals who think that by training with their militias all the time, that by being out there, that they are doing something, that they are at the ready. You know, I used to have access to the Oath Keepers guys and all those people, right?
Oh, really? They're the Oath Keepers are interesting to me. I've talked to a few of them over the years, and I know, the Oath Keepers and the militia types often get thrown in with, like, the Proud Boys and Patriot Prayer, but a lot of those Oath Keeper types I know, they hate all the alt-right kids. They're like, I don't like this racism stuff.
Yeah, well, so some of them, and here's the thing, regardless of what they claim about what they think about racism, well, here's an interesting thread that runs through a lot of them, and that is the white replacement argument. Okay.
That's definitely true with some of the older ones, too. Like, I remember Colonel Bo Gritz, who I really firmly believe was an informant for the FBI, but he would always say, I'm not racist. But he's like, I would not let my daughter date a black man. And he would talk about, like, all this really racial Christian identity stuff. But a lot of people in these patriot circles ignore that deliberately.
Yeah, well, they ignore a lot of interesting things. And one of the fascinating things is it created an alternate media, an alt media universe, during the time that Obama was in office, where a lot of people who had grudges with the system came together because they were unified under the banner of really hating what he was doing. And quite honestly, the reason why I got mixed up in it is because I was one of those people who did not appreciate Obama. Okay. And the moves that were being made and the fact that we're still not getting out of the wars and the fact that, you know, this guy is, going out with extrajudicial executions by drone strike. I mean, this kind of stuff, the fact that the NSA was getting more intrusive, the fact that, you know, it's like, well, where did Bush's agenda stop being implemented? Right. And I was against Bush. And, you know, at the time when I was a younger man, I voted for Bill Clinton. But, you know, I was rather deceived. He was just a cool guy playing a saxophone to me. But I have since learned a lot better and know exactly what this guy was about, which was pretty much hocking us up to our eyeballs with credit card debt. I mean, that's really what he comes down to in the reality of things. But, you know, we have had nothing but a string of crooked regimes that have been, you know, coming in and out the door, with the exception, to some degree, of Jimmy Carter.
I was just going to say, please say that you were going to say Jimmy Carter, because I actually, to some extent, like Jimmy Carter. I always note that whenever he's at the White House now doing a photo op with the other presidents, mm-hmm. he's always standing away from them. They don't stand near him. It's like he's an outsider to them in a lot of ways.
Well, he's one of the weird guys who, you know, again, thought he was in charge. Look, I have my arguments with him because I don't know if you've seen the recent series that Netflix put out, The Family.
You know, I've been trying to contact Jeff Charlotte about that. I like Jeff a lot. His work is really good. He's been doing this stuff for years.
Yes, yes. Look, you and I are on the same page with some of the people we want to interview. Carter is connected to that nexus, okay? So the nexus that connects Jimmy Carter with Donald Trump is what we're talking about there. That's something that I need to get into more and get a lot more details on, because, man, there has been this weird undertone of things that have been dominating the political levels of power during the course of my lifetime. Again, you know, because when I was born, Nixon was president. He was on his way out. And Ford becomes president. You know, the FBI stooge Ford, who was also a Warren Commission member. But another day we'll talk about that. And Carter takes office for one term and basically gets handcuffed by the establishment. Reagan comes in, you know, and if you take a look at the evolution of things, just the course of my lifetime, you know, there's one degree of separation between my lifetime and John F. Kennedy, and that's... Yeah, that's Lyndon Johnson, who was, you know, clearly a criminal as well. But I do not hang the assassination of JFK on around his neck. But plenty of other criminality to get into there. Thing is that we have a kakistocracy, as far as I'm concerned, which means that the worst of the worst people wind up ascending to power. And you see this across the board constantly, not just in the White House either. I mean, the White House is the easiest, you know, low-hanging fruit example, because that's where it's supposed to culminate, right? This is the representative of all the people, one way or another. That's like kind of like the spokesperson for this country. And I am thoroughly disgusted at what I see. And back to that nexus of right-wing media I was talking about. Here's the strange thing. There were a lot of people who had been involved in the mythology of old that, again, I tell you, was shared by the white nationalists, but didn't necessarily make you a white nationalist. You know, even when you take a look at the JFK and the silver certificate nonsense, that is something that you could have heard from the white Aryan resistance pulpit, as well as from William Cooper, as well as from Alex Jones, as well as, and I'm telling you right now, it's an interesting marker because it's a complete fallacy. Okay, regarding JFK and the silver certificate and the Federal Reserve killed him and all this stuff. It's a fallacy. Take a look at the executive order that they point to.
Are you familiar with G. Edward Griffin?
I sure am. I've had him on the show. And guess what? G. Edward Griffin agrees with me.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to open up a can of worms, but I've always found Griffin interesting within the right, because at one point he actually did a documentary called Anarchy USA, which really hammered on the civil rights movement. He was claiming MLK and all these people were just communist subversives and right. Sort of trashing them. That was back when he was involved with JBS, John Birch Society. But yeah, you see all these kind of weird connections like that.
No, you do. You absolutely do. And I got to tell you, he's not the only one who is at the foundation of literature who's got an interesting past when it comes to those things. You know, I don't want to necessarily out anybody, but there are people who have written about the invisible hand of government that controls things and the shadow government. And if you get and you speak with them on a personal level, you'll find out that they're very reactionary about, again, the white replacement thing and all that stuff.
Very anti-Semitic usually, too, I take it.
That, too. You know, because basically when they're saying bankers in a lot of cases, which I agree, that the international banking system is a criminal organization. But, you know, they will also very readily and very smoothly add in Jew. Okay, which is another bad sign when you take a look at the alt media that was developing 2008 to 2015. You see a big old pie being baked together with a lot of ingredients. And some of those ingredients included the white nationalist stuff and included the actually anti-Semitic stuff. And Zionism being the, you know, the justifiable way with which they could go Jew this, Jew that. This one's a Jew, so therefore he's in on it.
Yeah, and it's crazy because they just brush it to the side. You know, Alex Jones, I remember he used to have people on like Uton Gibson, Mel Gibson's dad, and Eustace Mullins, who wrote The Secrets of the Federal Reserve. Both of them are basically Nazis. I mean, Mullins, there was a copy of his book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, at my college, and I looked at it, and inside it was donated by the Aryan Brotherhood. But when people talk about Eustace Mullins within these Patriot Movement things, they never mention that kind of stuff. They just completely ignore it. Like, oh, he was just a researcher into the evil Federal Reserve.
No, and you also start to find that there are people that say, you know, the Holocaust hoax stuff, you know, we're also infecting the alternative media very much so. You know, the greatest story never told. Hitler was actually a hero. You know, all of the evidence that you know about from World War II, that's all faked. There were no death camps. You know, these people have absolutely infected the alt media. And look, prime example is, you know, look, I name names sometimes. Jim Fetzer is a prime example of this and is a guy I find wholly useless, even though I've attempted to work with him, you know.
For my listeners that don't know, Jim Fetzer is, you know, he was involved in the JFK assassination research community. He got involved in 9/11, but he believes in the craziest stuff imaginable. Like, right. He was talking in one interview about Mengele being in the sewers shooting at Kennedy in Dallas. And then, you know, with 9/11, he pushed stuff about, you know, holograms and laser beams or whatever, directed energy weapons, I guess.
And also micro-nuclear weapons, you know... You name it. He's also most famously been now, you know, taken care of in court, a summary judgment against him for, you know, causing the Sandy Hook parents to be harassed.
And this dude, I think, taught at a university. I mean, he was an academic that taught classes on critical thinking. Aye, aye, aye.
Yes, he did. And you know, here's a fun fact. You know, you don't even got to look at the argument I had with him on my show, the one time I attempted to bring him on my show. Don't even bother with that. I'll tell you what. You want to hear a wild incident? He went on Ground Zero Radio with Clyde Lewis. And guess who it was that actually suggested him for that spot? Me. All right? Now, why? Because Jim actually did a really good presentation about the concept of conspiracy theory in general, where, you know, he would explain to you that it was a much more natural and reasonable conclusion to assume that a conspiracy is what causes significant events in history to actually occur, as opposed to lone wolves, happenstance. And it was very logical, and it was very sensible. And I was told by the producers of Ground Zero, please, can you give us somebody who can do a presentation about how conspiracy theory is a logical thing? And I said, look, with great caution, you know, keep him on subject. But if you can get him to do his routine about that, you'll have a very good, solid presentation. Jim Fetzer, and here's his contact information, okay? He went on the show and immediately, you know, did kind of the same thing he did to me where, oh, and it's all about, you know, the hoaxes of history like the Holocaust. Okay, Clyde Lewis is on a couple hundred radio stations across the country. Holocaust denial is not something that's going to run on conservative radio stations across the country, okay? So you think the host wasn't going to push back? He did. And the next thing you know is Fetzer's screaming and yelling at him about, you know, what kind of a gatekeeper he is and all this stuff. A caller calls in. He says, I'm a friend of Clyde Lewis's. I can't believe you're insulting him like this. And he starts screaming, oh, you and your Jew boyfriend and this and that, totally off the rails. Okay? Live radio, hundreds of radio stations across the country. Yet this guy continues. And also.
Well, I just want to say, I could see Clyde Lewis going a Toxic Avenger on his ass. I'm sure only a small amount of people will get the joke there.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, listen, I know the joke. See, I know about the Toxic Avenger. And, hey, I'll spoil it. Clyde was actually the voice of the Toxic Avenger in two of the movies, I think. There's been like five or six, but he was the
voice of Toxie in Citizen Toxie, Toxic Avenger 4.
There you go. But I think he was the voice in one other movie too, but he was the voice of the Toxic Avenger, and I thought he did a great job. He's got a great voice, Clyde does. And I've been on his show too, and he's been on mine. But, you know, it was very strange because at that time I was, you know, getting guests for their producers a lot. They were calling me up last minute. We need a guy who can do this, and I got a lot of people on there. JP still has on there periodically, JP Satilli, who is just one of the most articulate and intelligent human beings I have ever encountered doing any of this.
A real gumshoe journalist.
Yeah, and I mean, solid journalist, great writer. I can't say enough about JP, man. And not just because he's Italian either do I compliment him. But, you know, well, maybe it's got something to do with it, but I love the guy. You know, he freaks out on there. This guy also had a situation. Have you ever heard of the Ace Baker suicide?
I remember when that happened. I used to listen to a lot of these radio shows online. And I was listening to, I think it was Deadline Live afterwards, and they were trying to figure out what happened. Yeah, this Ace Baker guy faked his own suicide on air at the end of a James Fetzer show.
During a James Fetzer show, and he just totally faked blowing his brains out on air as some sort of performance art. And if Jim Fetzer were to come out today and say that he has been doing performance art for the past 20 years, I would absolutely applaud and respect his efforts, because he has convinced me of, being a tremendously great actor if he doesn't believe the crap he's pushing, or if somebody's not paying him to do it. I don't know. But it is amazing to me that he's always got the resources to put out stuff, to travel, and to do a lot of other things. I don't know if a retired professor from a small college should really be able to afford a lot of what he's done. But I don't make accusations unless I can really make them. But this guy's track record is amazing, and he's just nothing but a disruptive force, and he's brought, the worst of the worst stuff into the equation. And meanwhile, he's not even necessarily part of the right-wing nexus or the Patriot stuff, but he's in there. He got baked into the pie, you see.
Yeah, and he used to present himself as being like a very left-wing kind of guy, and then, he gets into the Holocaust denial and the sort of stuff that Nazis are into. I mean, it's really weird.
Right. I mean, and nowadays, if you ask him about just about anything, it is the state of Israel that's responsible for everything.
And literally everything is a false flag attack.
And every piece of evidence you ever see is absolutely fictitious, right? Well, what about the medical evidence, Jim? It's faked. Okay, well, what about the films, Jim? It's faked. What about the files, Jim? They're all fakes. Okay, Jim.
Yeah, he was one of the people that pushed the 9/11 was like a videotaped hoax. It was fake video.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the Ace Baker thing happened. Mm-hmm. Baker was like, see, this proves that you can fake stuff because I did this fake suicide on the radio. I mean, right. It's some of the most offensive things people could do.
See, side note is the producer of that show that day was my producer for a short time afterwards. So that was Danny Romero over at American Freedom Radio later. But at that time, I think it was like We the People Radio or something like that. And Deadline Live, that's hilarious, too, because I used to call into the Jack Blood show. And Jack was to Deadline Live, right? So funny that you mention all that stuff. And Jack, unfortunately, has, totally decided to step outside of the game. I mean, from the time he replaced me on AFR after I left to now, he left there after a little bit and has not come back. And does not want to come back to this mess that is alternative media any longer. And I miss Jack, by the way, personal friend, actually. And I miss him. He's out there in Seattle now doing his thing. And
he had really good taste in music. That's half the reason why I would listen to his show, is just because he would be playing like Ministry, A Perfect Circle, Dead Kennedys, just all kinds of stuff that I was into.
Well, a side note about that is you realize that Jack was, the whole grunge movement of the 90s, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of those guys were Jack's friends. And Jack would bands with some of those guys.
Jack would what?
You
cut out for a second.
The people from Soundgarden and Pearl Jam and stuff like that. These were guys, local musicians swap around in different bands for a while. Jack Blood had been in bands with some of those guys before they made it.
Wow.
He's doing that on the West Coast while I was on the East Coast, opening for Gigi Allen and
the Murder Junkies.
The Murder Junkies, which is a weird story in and of itself. But I mean, I opened for a lot of people, Pantera on their last club tour, bands that, unless you're really deep into the underground of stuff, you probably don't know, like Suffocation, Cannibal Corpse, Cannibal Corpse, a lot of people know, but they had a band album around the time that I opened for them. Let me think. Who else? I was part of the very first Jersey Metal Fest. Who else did I open for? Nuclear Assault. That's an easy one. Dear God, MOD, the Method of Destruction, Billy Milano's band, showed up in a short bus, decked out in camouflage to the gig, by the way, there at the Fast Lanes in Asbury Park. I've known some interesting people and opened for some interesting bands over the years. Rob Halford did not want me to open for him when he did the Fight Tour. I was personally rejected by Rob Halford. Let's see. Who else? I had dealings with Peter Steele. He's dead now.
Oh, Typo Negative.
Yeah, that guy. Good God. complaining that he had the wrong kind of bottled water in his dressing room. It's prima donna.
Oh, he was a prima donna in addition to, like, he said some stuff that was, like, really kind of, like, I mean, he was politically incorrect before politically incorrect was a thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, look, see his band Carnivore. You want to get
Jesus, it. Hitler, and Race Riot. Some of the song titles for folks out there.
There you go. You know, Jenna Torturers was a band.
Oh, I love the Jenna Torturers. I'm huge into industrial metal. Jenna Torturers was like my jam, like in high school in the first years of college.
There you go. There you go. So, I mean, interesting nexus of people I worked with, right? And opened for and dealt with and, the band Overkill, those are great guys from Jersey also. And I used to love when they would come back home because they would stay at a friend of mine's house instead of a hotel. And that used to be a lot of fun. You know, we were happy for Zach Wilde when he got the job with Ozzy. He was in a band called Zyrus in Jersey. I mean, there's a lot of interesting individuals I encountered there, but, There's the Murder Junkie story, which I told you in a Twitter message, I think. wonder if your listeners know who G.G. Allin was.
I'm pretty sure they know who G.G. Allin is if they're listening to me, but he's the great shock rocker of punk, you know, just throwing poop at people and other very nasty things at punk shows.
Yeah,
basically did his shows naked.
Yeah, did his shows naked, or in some venues they made him wear a jockstrap. His drummer was completely naked most of the time. Interesting.
Their drummer is still naked during shows. I was at a show, last year that Merle put on with the Murder Junkies. Merle being Gigi's brother for listeners.
Merle, who is actually the weirdest looking of them all, is one of the most normal people that was involved in that band. He looks strange, but he's like really just a kind of down to earth guy. And how do I know this? Cause I actually had to do business with him. Why? When Gigi would travel, okay. They didn't bring their own equipment. Okay. They would sign an agreement with one of the opening bands that if, you know, your equipment was rendered unusable by them, that they would pay for it or replace it on the spot before they left. So they used our equipment, my band's equipment, after we opened for them. Okay. And they had to replace a couple things. Because, you know, the drummer broke part of my drummer's drum set, and there was no real major damage to anything else. The guitar player, the bass player, everything was cool there. They didn't blow up anything. Gigi did some serious damage to a mic cable, and that was about it. Outside of doing other weird things during the show, like, you know, bleeding all over dudes and kissing them, tongue kissing dudes in the front row, and randomly urinating all over the club and things like that, as he was doing, you know, songs like let me think here. I think it's I kill everything that I don't know if we can curse on your podcast.
You can go ahead. I kill everything I fuck.
I kill everything I fuck. Exactly. And you know, running around doing that, whipping himself out because in Jersey, technically speaking, he had to have the jock strap on, even though he was hanging out of it most of the time anyway. The funniest thing is that I know there's film that exists of that night, and I've never seen it surface anywhere. And part of the film will contain the guys from the band bowling at a bowling alley before the show, because the Asbury Park Lanes is right next to the club called the Fast Lanes. But anyway, Gigi dies one show later. He goes and plays at a place called the Gas Station, I think.
That's all on film, by the way.
Which is on film, but it only lasted like, what, two songs? And then he jumped through a window, smashed that, went to the friend's place and, I don't know, jacked up and killed himself with a heroin overdose, I think. And this is after years, by the way, of threatening to kill himself on stage. You know, it was too funny. So they kind of liked my performance, the rest of the guys in the band. I didn't really talk to Gigi. Because he was walking around in like a very filthy looking, like overcoat, like a, like almost like a long white lab coat, but all dirty, like a dirty lab coat, before he jumped on stage and dropped it, and he's in his jock strap and his boots, which is very typical of a G.G. Allin show.
It's a sight to behold. It's a spectacle.
Yeah, and you know, and I drank with him at the bar, but we really didn't have much of a conversation. But the guys in the band liked what I did before they went on, because I was often compared to a combination of like Stiv Bators Max Cavalera. Like if you combined Max Cavalera and Stiv Bators, that was kind of like what my stage presence was like. So I don't know how to explain that any better. Look up those guys if you don't know who it is. Stiv Bators was the singer for the Dead Boys, and Max at the time was still in Sepultura, I think.
And he was in the great industrial metal band Nailbomb, which no one talks about anymore, and I love that band.
Nailbomb, the Cavalera Conspiracy, a lot of good stuff from Max. Love him. Anyway, but with Stiv Bators, who has passed away, again, you know, the guy from the Dead Boys. I still love the song Sonic Reducer. It's one of the things I play constantly in my playlist. Anyways, but they liked what I did. Now, Gigi's dead a few weeks after the gig, and apparently they wanted to contact me and see if I would front the Murder Junkies after Gigi was dead. And I was living in the East Village at the time. When I ran into them at a bar called Doc Holliday's, a couple of months later, they had put out ads, and I didn't know about it because I wasn't reading the trades at the time, that they were looking for a new singer and all that good stuff. And apparently they were like, oh, gee, we wish we had been able to run into you because you would have been perfect. it was at a bar called Doc Holliday's in the East Village again. And I just sort of ran into Merrill, and I can't remember the guitarist's name, sort of a heavy set dude, like long curly hair. I can't remember his name though at all. But the drummer wasn't there. It was just Merrill and him. And they were like, oh, we wish we could have gotten a hold of you. Cause you would have been great.
you know, it's funny. Merrill is like quite the character. I still see him on Facebook from time to time. I wanted to do an interview, but he will not talk about GG anymore. He's just like, I've done too many interviews about it, which I can understand, but it's funny because I think he does this just to mess with people. He'll post about Donald Trump and he'll be like, well, at least we have a hot first lady. Oh, Melania. I'm like, right. This dude's a character. He tries to sell like, you know, he'll sell his locks of hair to people. He'll be like, buy Merle Allen's hair. Gigi's brother. Merle's funny. Man,
does you know, he?
What's
you know,
that?
I haven't seen him in years and years. Does he still have that crazy mustache?
Yeah, he does. He does.
Oh, I love that. You know, the wild thing is, you see Merle, and all you really would see is this weird swoosh of hair in front of his mouth, and like always with the dark round sunglasses everywhere he went. Even when I saw him in the bar that night, that's exactly how he was dressed, with like something that looked like you might wear a hat like on the Australian outback. And like that exact, the dark sunglasses, even though it was like, you know, midnight, and and the mustache, you know, fully out there and, you know, groomed in exactly the right way. There he was in full dress like that all the time, just walking out having a beer with his bandmate, right?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny because I was gonna add you know. A lot of people are like, I can't understand why anyone likes Gigi Allin. Look, like, I've shown people the concert footage, and they're like, why do you like this? And I'm like, I've always liked the fact that, like, I feel like Gigi probably played stuff up a lot, and that's part of the joke. I mean, he had Tiny Tim on one of his albums, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know Jeff from, Anti-Scene has said he thinks Gigi played some stuff up, but some of the antics Gigi would engage in is just like such a total fuck you to the system. Like he was interviewed by some like New Zealand like zine once, and they were like, we heard in your press kit that you like to lie to the press. And he's like, I didn't say that, my press kit said that. He was a funny motherfucker.
No, he definitely was. And you know why? All right, now I'm going to tell you why it is they were willing to recruit me, right? Because here's the thing about Gigi. As much as a lot of people think it was an act and, you know, and whatever, legitimately, I knew one of the guys who was standing in the front row at the show, right? That Gigi was like, you know, gave him a bloody full tongue mouth kiss during the show, just random dude at the front row of the show. okay, I knew the guy. His name was Brian. And it was not staged. It was not planned. Okay. None of this was. The running around and watching a lot of audience members like clear like he's parting the Red Sea, you know, throughout a packed club was hilarious to me. When he was just running around urinating everywhere. And then there was, you know, other sections of the crowd jumping to get urinated on. And I don't know if that stuff was captured on film. I've never really watched a lot of his shows or anything and barely even knew the guy until I opened my, I had seen him on like, one of those talk shows at the time, was making the big rounds and I can't remember whose talk show it was.
It may have been Jerry Springer where he,
yes, that's it.
Yeah. He was the parents were like, getting all up in arms and, like, you know, just flapping their arms angrily because he was like, I own your children.
Your children are mine. Doesn't matter anyway. I don't give a damn. <You know? laughs> Sitting there. And yeah, doing that. It was just so reprehensible, so ridiculous. So, you know, he said before he did that song, you know, I kill everything I fuck. I want to get AIDS so I can kill everything that I fuck. You know, it was just like the most outlandish, outrageous, you know, and it's just like making an interesting point as far as I'm concerned. But the reason
so many people have tried to replicate him now, too. I mean, you know, the dwarves, I interviewed Vag Moore from the dwarves, actually. I mean, the dwarves, I don't think exist without Gigi Allen beforehand.
You know, maybe not. I don't know, you know, too many people that would claim him as an influence, but it's really just this interesting chapter in punk history. And again, here's the reason why, you know, the murder junkies would consider me. First of all, I could not, here's something that I didn't used to tell people at the time, but the stage lighting used to completely render me blind, right? That kind of gave me a weird freedom. Because I would actually have a roadie who would describe to me exactly how much stage I had to work with and map it out for me verbally. I would have to work from memory when I was on stage. But during those time periods I was on stage, I would also dive into the audience. I was well known for that. And, strangling myself with the mic cable and, things like this. And I would jump into an audience that would be standing there watching us and open up a mosh pit by throwing people into each other or, you know, getting into like quick fist fights during musical breaks of songs during my show. This is why they thought I would have been perfect.
But I guess it was not meant to be.
No, it was not meant to be. And the fact is that, see, now there's like a punk element of my, you know, heavy metal stuff I was doing is, you know, that engagement with the crowd. A lot of people, you know, even if you want to talk, you know, let's think for a minute, right? Who would be the most iconic guy like that? He did a guest spot on Star Trek. What is it? Iggy Pop.
Yeah.
Who, like, you know, you interacted with your audience. That was the key thing about punk that I loved, is that, you know what, I could go down there and kick somebody, and I could go down there and punch somebody in the head, and we would knock each other on the floor, and whether there was broken glass on the floor or not didn't matter. You get thrown into a pillar, this kind of thing, and they would throw me back up on stage. So, you know, because they knew when I was about ready to have to sing again, they'd throw me back up on stage. And at the end of the night, everybody was friends. There wasn't no picking a fight about it. It was like, that was good. We just got out a whole lot of aggression and nobody got, you know, in trouble. You know what I'm saying? It was all legal in there. To me, that was a freeing experience, you know. And you were tired. You were tired. You were a little beat up, and your aggressions had been gotten out at the punk shows, so that, you know, maybe you didn't go home and kick your dog or smack your girlfriend, you know, because there was just a lot of angry guys out there at the time, and this was a good way for them to blow off steam.
But you're still sort of like family at the end in the punk scene, metal scene, I've noticed.
But that was the thing, is at the end of the night, it was like, hey, you know what? We're still friends, you know? And I tell you again that the whole starting point for me diving into darkness is that I could not see, which was the best element of it. Sometimes I'd get caught by the crowd. Sometimes they would part. I never knew what was going to happen until I hit something, which is, again, just a fun experience for me. It was just a great thing to be alive to do that, you know. So when thinking about a guy like Gigi, who, again, I mean, I can't get into defecating all over the stage and all that, which he did, but he would bleed. I bled on stage a few times. I banged my head or whatever, and wound up getting sliced by something, you know, that was thrown at me and things like that. But he would almost always bleed. He would almost always either urinate or defecate. And so, you know, bleeding for me was okay, but I wasn't going to take a dump on the stage. You know, it wasn't my thing. But I could see how somebody would go to those sorts of extreme levels in a performance art sense. Obviously I don't behave like this today. I don't even curse on my radio show, you know, but, and I'm not looking to fight anybody. You know, I walk around on a cane, at this point, cause I can barely walk and all that. I mean, you know, my body's been through a ringer, so I'm good. But at the time when I was young and dumb and had a lot of energy and a lot of aggression and a lot of things to express, that's really what I was all about. Funny thing, though, again, is that you wouldn't picture that guy during his off time going, let me see if I can interview this Dallas police officer who's moved to this part of Canada now because I read about him in a book. But that's what I was doing during my off time. So, yeah, maybe I'm weird. JG, what do you think?
Well, I think we're all a little bit weird if we're doing parallax views, but there was, you know, there's one more thing I wanted to ask you. I know we're tight on time, but since we were talking about the Patriot movement and conspiracy shock jocks and the militia movement, and even the family that now has a Netflix series about them, are you familiar with a group called the CNP?
Off the top of my head, it's not ringing a bell.
Council for National Policy. I believe it was founded by Tim LaHaye.
Okay.
I've always found it fascinating that guys like Jack McLamb, who was sort of a Bo Gritz clone that worked at a Patriot radio network, Dr. Stanley Monteith, Alex Jones, Jerome Corsi, all those people were involved in the CNP, which was founded as a right-wing version of the CFR.
Right.
And it's really fascinating to me because it's a really secretive group. And yet all the people that are in it like to talk about how they hate the Bilderbergs, they hate the Bohemian Grove, they hate all that stuff, but they're in a secret society themselves. The CMP operates in secret. That's something very telling to me about the whole Patriot movement. They never mention that.
No, they never mention the people that are involved in a whole lot of secretive organizations one way or another. You know, some of them will present the whole Freemasonry argument one way or another. Which is another bizarre nexus of individuals, right? You know,
they often use British Freemasonry as like a code for like Jews, essentially, I've noticed.
Yeah, you know, but here's the thing. That's one of those adaptable codes, right? Because, you know, you have Freemason lodges here in America, and they'll talk to you about the, you know, the porch Freemasons, right? The guys who are out front, who are out on the front porch, right? And they'll tell you that once you get into the inside of the organization, the inner sanctum, so to speak, you know, this is where the real business is done and all that. You know, and on some levels, they are correct. Every secret society has, you know, these sort of public relation elements to it. And then they have the inner circles, you know, and it's just, I don't know, it just seems to be the organizing principle of power, where that is part of the reality. But it's fascinating to see people that are involved in organizations just like that, seeming to battle with other organizations that are very similar to their own. It makes you wonder sometimes, like, is that all just a show, very much like the left-right paradigm is in this country? And that's, see, there's where my real problem is, by the way, is that left or right, the way I see it is, it's all part of the same corporation, and it is the government of, for, and by the corporation, and they are all just actors, very much like the WWE functions. You know, you got your good guys, you got your bad guys. Some people root for the good guys, some people root for the bad guy, and sometimes the sides switch around, and there's a whole lot of play acting that goes into it. But at the end of the day, they're all paid by the same corporation. They all get the paycheck from the same place, and they're all just out there as actors. Some of them better actors than others. And that's the way I feel about most of what we consider to be mainstream politics at this point. And the media plays its role. We're attacking Donald Trump. We're attacking Donald Trump. Let's go to a break. Here's your 2020 Trump presidential campaign ad. You know, we're all liberals. We're about the environment. Here's our sponsor, the National Oil Association. It's hilarious to watch the deceptions that are conducted right in front of people's faces that they cannot, will not, and fail to acknowledge constantly. When it comes to that right-wing patriot media stuff, though, one thing I want to say is that there are various elements that broke out of that afterwards. And one of them is the pro-Trumpet thing, which is, you know, the QAnons. And here's a place for all of you right-wing conspiracy theory people to go. And quite frankly, I know factually that there was money available for people to amp up that stuff in 2015. How do I know that? Because I was offered some of it. Okay. Get on the side of Donald Trump. In 2015, when I'm still saying the guy's a joke, Roger Stone's on my show. I said, look, the guy's a joke. I'm here to talk to you about Clinton, but I want to talk to you about Trump next time because this is pathetic. And Stone told me a bit of truth on my show, which I will never forget, which is another part of the equation that we often forget as well. And that is that, you know, you fail to, he said to me, you fail to recognize the level of narcissistic personality you're dealing with when it comes to this guy. You think he's a joke. He's serious. And that is exactly the kind of guy you use to implement an agenda. Somebody who can be made to believe they're king while the kingdom is really being run by the same people who always ran it. The oil in his presidency, the continued amping up of the military in his presidency, the really truthfully business as usual for the most part in his presidency, regardless of the rhetoric, is evidence of the fact that even this ridiculous, seemingly damaged, narcissistic, sociopathic piece of garbage that is allegedly our president at this point is going to fall in line right along with the guy he claims to oppose, the guy who was the slick sail from Madison Avenue, who was Barack Obama before that, who, by the way, in my estimation, was basically Bush dark, because Bush beer, Bush dark, there you go. Here's a guy with brown skin who's going to continue the agenda. Everybody with brown skin, calm down now. I agree with KRS-One. Before that, you had Bush. Before that, you had the Bush crime syndicate family member, as far as I'm concerned, in Clinton. You had Bush again, except it was a different Bush. You had Bush puppeting Ronald Reagan. Okay? You have the interruption there with Jimmy Carter. But again, I go back and back and back in my entire history, and all I can see is the same pattern over and over again. And they have created a lot of designed things to distract us. They have allowed certain mythologies to prevail one way or another. And at this point, when you take a look at the bizarre nexus of possibilities when it comes to the Jeffrey Epstein thing, this is now the culmination of weaponizing confusion that is at its apex right now. So, you know, for the jerk who said, may you live in interesting times, I have a big fuck you for you. Because we are living in them, and I'm not appreciating it much. I'd like to get to some sanity. I'd like to get away from, you know, the alternate reality that we're in. I don't believe in the Mandela effect, but I really wish I did, because I want to go to another universe. I want to go to another timeline. I'm not enjoying this one. And, you know, the only blessing I feel at this point is that, you know what, my time on this earth is shorter, what I have left, than what I've already put in. So at least I'm more than halfway to death. So I'm kind of happy about that. but at the same time, I shudder for what it is we're leaving for future generations with this, you know, disinformation salad, this madness of, you know, let's amp up the things that are questionable and create, you know, ultimate layers of ridiculousness around them, generated by people like Jim Fetzer, generated by people like Judy Baker, generated by, Alex Jones, generated by all of the disinformation artists, whether they have a corporate contract, they have a $1 million operation, or they're just a useful idiot with a podcast. I'm going to tell you right now, we got to do better than this, JJ. We really do, man.
Well, amen to that, brother. You know, we're going to have to do a part two in the very near future. We didn't even get into the Charles Manson and Zena LaVey stuff.
Which I can get into, yes. And look, anytime you want to do this, that's fine. You know, if you found anything resonating that I said with you, the listener, not you, JJ, but you, the listener, you know, please go over to Ocelli.com. O-C-H-E-L-L-I. It's my last name. And I just put that as .com because some idiot bought OcelliEffect.com and tried to sell it to me for a lot of money. So when I established the website, I just went with my last name.com. And it's not because of ego. It's because of lack of imagination that I put my name on everything. So there you go. I want to thank you, man, for indulging me for this time period, listening to me rant and rave about a few things and asking some questions I've never been asked before. So I appreciate it, man.
Well, I appreciate you coming on Parallax Views, Chuck Ocelli. Well, that does it for this Ocelli Effect edition of Parallax Views. Be sure to check out Chuck Ocelli's work at Ocelli.com. That's OCHELLI.com. You can listen to Chuck's show, The Age of Transitions with Aaron Franz, and Porkin's Policy Review. I even hear that there's going to be a few more shows in production at the Ocelli Effect Network, so check it out, folks. Also, want to thank again my Patreons for helping keep this show alive and well. Couldn't do it without you, folks. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.